This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. On Friday evening, a magnitude 7.5 earthquake struck central Sulawesi province in Indonesia. Within a half hour, an 18-foot wave headed toward the province's capital, Palu. One video shows a man standing on top of a parking structure yelling as huge waves hit the shore, pushing buildings into a roadway.
Inilah tsunami! Inilah tsunami! Inilah tsunami, ya Allah! Ya Allah, tsunami, ya Allah! Ya Allah, kota Palu, ya Allah!
The death toll continues to rise, now above 1,300 people. Rescue crews are still searching for survivors, and tensions are rising. People are taking desperate actions to find food. Skirmishes between civilians and police have escalated because supplies are getting harder to come by. Journalist Rebecca Henschke is in Palu for the BBC.
What was tightly packed houses and shops all now reduced to rubble. People here say they only had a few minutes warning after that strong quake on Friday to flee to higher ground when they saw huge waves coming in. Those that could survive did so by clinging onto trees and buildings. Now families are camping out in the open, like this family over here that's collected what they can and are surviving off the food they have. There's no power here and very little fresh food or fresh water. So people are saying that they desperately need to get aid in.
That's the BBC's Indonesia editor, Rebecca Henschke. Now, reports suggest people on shore did not get adequate warnings about the tsunami. But earthquakes and tsunamis typically go together. So how could such a massive natural disaster take so many people by surprise? Let's discuss it with Professor Louise Comfort, the former director of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Disaster Management. She's been working on the U.S. side to develop a tsunami warning system for the area with a grant from the National Science Foundation. Professor Comfort, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
I should note we'll be discussing this for just the first part of our program before we move on. So if you have questions or thoughts about the Indonesia quake or tsunami, now's the time to send them in, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Before we talk about Indonesia specifically, give us just kind of a basic seismology lesson. Why do earthquakes and tsunamis go together?
Well, the tsunami is caused by an undersea either earthquake or landslide, and that is a rupture of the ocean floor where part of the ocean floor goes up, the other part goes down, and it displaces a huge volume of water, and that causes the tsunami.
Kind of like if you stomp your foot in a bathtub and it makes a wave.
Exactly. Exactly. Only a very big wave.
Exactly. Do we have a better sense geologically, seismologically, what happened in Indonesia this weekend, what it was within and on top of the earth that caused all this devastation?
Well, actually, the geologists are still searching for an explanation. One explanation was that there was a very large body of sediment that was located under the earthquake, and that would be consistent with an undersea landslide. So they don't know yet. The epicenter itself likely triggered this movement, and the displacing the water is what caused the tsunami.
Can you give us a sense of what it takes to investigate something like this? Are we talking about satellite imagery or divers, or what kinds of data are being collected right now?
Satellite imagery is certainly being collected, and that's available, but that only shows you the top of the ocean. And what you really need is depth sounding. It's called bathymetry, and this would take a ship that would do soundings to reach the depth of the ocean and try to identify exactly where the rupture occurred and where the shift of the ocean floor occurred that generated the tsunami.
Professor, it seems like the size of the tsunami caught some people by surprise. Why was this so apparently unexpected?
Well, I'm sorry to say, earthquakes and tsunamis are not unexpected in Indonesia. It lies on the Ring of Fire. And there is a major earthquake somewhere in Indonesia every year, an earthquake above 7 on the Richter scale. So that part is not a surprise. The actual event always catches people by surprise because they're not thinking about it at the time, and just is in every area experiences hazards, and people on the Gulf Coast aren't always watching for a hurricane. People in California aren't always watching for an earthquake. And it was a similar phenomenon of people going about their daily affairs, not thinking about a tsunami, and then it occurs.
What about the size of the tsunami? Did that meet up with expectations?
Well, the size actually was probably increased or heightened by the formation of the shore and the narrow bay of in which it entered to strike the city of Palu. And what is the case with water is if it's channeled in a narrow bay, the waters is going to rise. And so the height of 18 feet or, 6 meter tsunami was really shaped by the rock formation of the bay through which it entered.
We are speaking to Louise Comfort, former director of Pitt's Center for Disaster Management. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well. 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A. Or you can comment on our Facebook page. That's what Joanne did. And Joanne wrote, "The coverage on BBC is so hard to see. The destruction is unbelievable with death everywhere and no way to get help to those in life-threatening danger. They need our help." Zachary wrote on our website, the1a.org, "The rescuers have not even been able to reach the worst hit places yet. Many thousands probably dead or dying at this moment." Professor Comfort, there had been a lot of talk about prevention and international efforts after that huge tsunami in 2004. It killed 250,000 people. What happened after that? Did some post-2004 effort fail us?
No, it didn't fail. This is a very hard problem. It's a very complex problem. A lot of international aid poured into Indonesia at the time. Indonesia itself made a major effort to develop a better disaster management plan, disaster warning efforts. And the U.S. Contributed science, technology, buoys, Germany, France, Japan, most of the nations in the United Nations group contributed to developments in Indonesia. But it's a difficult problem. And Indonesia, in an archipelago with 17,000 plus islands, is hard to protect. So it also needs, I think, a continuing international collaboration to build the science, to develop the technology for undersea measurements of tsunamis that will enable people to have better and more accurate knowledge of where the tsunamis are likely to occur.
So the warning system in place in Indonesia, why did that not work? Was it a technological error, a human error? What went wrong?
Well, again, it's difficult to do. Indonesia has several different measurements in place. The seismometer network did function. They were able to locate the epicenter and the magnitude of the earthquake. What they did not have in place were buoys that would measure the displacement of the water in the ocean floor. And that's critical. It's expensive. The research project that I have led in collaboration with Indonesian colleagues is still in the testing phase. It was actually stalled, but we need to move that forward. And again, I think it takes an international effort. Tsunamis are not just a problem for Indonesia. They're a problem for coastal cities across the world.
Give us a sense of what the tsunami warning system that you're working on would do and where that project stands.
Well, this project was ready for installation this fall. It consists of a network of underwater sensors that use a bottom pressure sensor to measure the change in the water column. The data are then communicated via communication sensors under the water and would go to a cable shore station that would transmit the data via satellite to the Indonesian agency, BMKG, where the scientists would validate the records and indicate, make a decision on a tsunami warning and the level of the tsunami warning. That information would then go out to the provinces and the cities' emergency operations centers, and they would send communications to the neighborhoods and the people. Mm-hmm. We had also been working on a wireless network of electronic devices, essentially handheld devices, that would create a temporary hotspot in the communities that would enable people to exchange information and essentially rescue themselves. One of the difficulties in Palu was that the electricity was out, the cell towers were down, there was no means of communication, and this made the evacuation on land very, very difficult.
Professor Louise Comfort, former director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Disaster Management. Professor Comfort, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll shift gears and speak to astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson on space and the military, plus your questions for him about the final frontier or just about anything else. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.